saw a study years ago where they asked young people, do you think most people are selfish and out to get you?
Mm-hmm.
And 71% said, yes, I agree with that statement. And I can't imagine trying to go through life thinking that most people are selfish and out to get you. Of course, you're going to try to be friends with your AI.
Welcome to the Mona Charon Show. So glad you could join us today. I am delighted to welcome David Brooks, New York Times columnist, author, television commentator, who has written many books, but the most recent, which is now out in paperback, is called How to Know a Person, How the Art of Seeing and Being Deeply Seen. Am I getting the subtitle wrong, David?
That's the gist. You got the gist.
I got the gist. All right. Well, it's a wonderful book, and I so appreciate your coming on to talk about it. So this is a book that has tremendous amounts of research and learning and philosophy, but at the root of what I took away from this book is that it is a moral argument. It's about character formation. How do you respond to that reaction?
I'm pleased by that reaction. First of all, it's great to be on the show, Mona. We've known each other for a long time and have been friends for a long time, so it's good to be working together. Yeah,
yes.
It really is a moral question. It started because in our society, so many people feel invisible and unseen. And that shows up in mental health problems. It shows up in suicide. It shows up in political resentment. People who feel that people on the coast don't see them, don't get them. And so I came to believe that the central skill in any country or family or organization is the ability to make other people feel seen, heard, and understood. And that is an essential moral act. One of the people who influenced me was a French mystic named Simone Weil, who wrote that attention is the ultimate form of generosity.
Mm.
And so when you attend to somebody, you're paying them the compliment of respect. And that's how connection is built. And one of the people who was most influenced by Simone Weil was an English writer, a novelist, and philosopher named Iris Murdoch. And Murdoch said that we tend to see each other with self-centered eyes. How is this person good for me? How are they making me feel? And Murdoch said our goal should be to cast what she called a just and loving attention on others. And that is the foundation of morality. Murdoch has this little example where it's a mother-in-law thinking about her daughter-in-law. So the mother-in-law thinks her daughter-in-law is kind of immature and spoiled. But she realizes, the mother-in-law, that she's kind of a snob. And she can be a little snobby. And so she decides, I'm going to think about my daughter-in-law in different ways. I'm going to see her not as immature, but as fresh. Not as spoiled, but dynamic. And she's going to cast a just and loving attention. And just one final story I put in the book to illustrate how this can work is that I was at a diner in Waco, Texas, interviewing a lady who was 93. Her name was Rue Dorsey. She, in fact, died last month. She presents herself to me as a strict disciplinarian, which say, like, she was a teacher, and she said, I love my students enough to be tough with them. And I was a little intimidated by this intense, like drill sergeant type lady. Into the diner walks a mutual friend of ours, a guy named Jimmy Durrell, who's a pastor. He pastors to the homeless in Waco. And he comes up to where he knows us both, and he grabs Mrs. Dorsey by the shoulders and shakes her way harder than you should ever shake a 93-year-old. And he says to her, Mrs. Dorsey, Mrs. Dorsey, you're the best. You're the best. I love you. I love you. And in that instant, that lady who had been a drill sergeant to me turns into a bright, eye-shining 9-year-old girl. He brought forth a better version of her by the sheer power of his gaze. And that is a moral act. It's a very subtle moral act, but it is the foundation of all the other rest of our morality.
So I remember both of those stories very well. The Iris Murdoch story about the mother-in-law thinking that she's going to reframe the way she sees her daughter-in-law. If I'm remembering correctly, you say that nothing in her outward behavior changed, mother-in-law's, but that she changed her framing, her way of thinking about it, and it helped. And I remember thinking, I doubt that. I mean, that I doubt that her outer being didn't at some level convey some of that snobbiness, some of that, a little bit of contempt that she might have had for that daughter-in-law. And I bet the daughter-in-law knew. How do you react to that?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I'd never thought of that. But I totally agree because, you know, 99% of our thinking is unconscious.
Right.
And we're just like a little boy riding on the elephant. And if the elephant really thinks your daughter-in-law is a little immature, then the boy's going to behave in that way too.
Yeah.
And that illustrates something we ignore in our society, the difference between inner light and outer behavior. And you can have outer behavior, that's fine. But if your inner light is not doing so well, your outer behavior is going to deteriorate. I read recently about a philosophical exercise. Imagine two guys named John and Joe. And John, every time he sees a woman, he's tempted to want to go sleep with her. And it happens every time. He just wants to sleep with these beautiful women. And he realizes he shouldn't because he loves his wife and he loves his family and he doesn't want to cheat on them. And then there's another guy, Joe, who never is tempted by other women. He loves his wife so much, his love for her has overwhelmed any temptation he might feel for another person in that way. And so who would we say is really more virtuous? I think it's the guy who has the inner light, who doesn't feel tempted, rather than the guy who's constantly having to fight off temptation.
I don't know. I mean, there, maybe, on the other hand, the one who successfully resists the temptation might get more points for self-discipline.
That gets more points for self-discipline, but for me, not for complete lovingness.
No, that is true. Because the very fact that he has this constant wandering eye suggests that there's something lacking in his ability to love.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
So your book is, as I say, it's multi-layered, and you devote a lot of time to how is it that we get to know another person deeply? And of course, a lot of that revolves around how we listen and how we talk to other people. And you not only describe good interactions with people you call illuminators and contrast them with diminishers. And we've all had experience with both kinds of people, but you give concrete examples of how to talk and how not to talk. And one of the unfortunate tendencies that I picked up on immediately, because I had a friend growing up who did this all the time, was you talk about those people who are, as you're speaking, their eyes kind of glaze over and they're just waiting for you to stop, for your lips to stop moving so that they can talk again.
Yeah.
Right.
I got this from some improv teacher, and he says, imagine, he sticks out his arm, you can't see it in my little screens here, but he says, imagine we're having a conversation and I start my comment, and it's really important to me what I'm saying, at my shoulder, and it extends all the way, and I'm going to talk until my fingertips. At mm-hmm. what point have you stopped listening so you can think of what to say? It's probably like halfway down the arm.
Right.
And the problem with that is as you start thinking, what should I say next in response? You stop listening. It's the same brain area that handles both. So what you should do is let me talk to my fingertips, to the end of my arm, then pause and reflect and then answer. And don't mm-hmm. fear the pause. And I learned from some book I read during the research that Japanese people are more comfortable with a pause. I think they're comfortable with an 8-second pause. And that it's a sign of respect. We
yeah.
are not, and I'm a New Yorker. To me, an 8-millisecond pause is a problem. Like, I just want to fill every silence.
Right.
But do it's a respectful thing to do.
Yes. So listening. And then describe what a topper is in conversation.
Yeah, a topper is, and I do this all the time, even though I wrote a damn book about it. If somebody says to you, you know, I just had a terrible flight. We were on the tarmac for 2 hours. And I want to say in response, you know, I had a terrible flight once. I know what you're going through. We were on the tarmac for 6 hours. And it sounds like I'm trying to relate to you. But what I'm really saying is let's pay less attention to your inferior set of experiences and more attention to my superior experiences. And so it's a way to hijack the conversation back to myself. And that's self-centeredness.
Right. So, okay. So, and you also describe, if you will, there's this acronym, SLANT, which you didn't invent, but you mention it. So this is a technique for how to engage in conversation. Why don't you describe that?
So it's about how to listen. And so one of the keys of that is don't treat attention as an on-off switch, not a dimmer. That if you're going to attend to somebody, do it 100% or 0%. Don't try to 60-40 it and be looking at your phone. And the other thing is to be a loud listener. I've got a buddy, some of your listeners and viewers may know, named Andy Crouch. When you talk to Andy, it's like talking to one of those charismatic Pentecostal churches. He's like, yes, I agree, preach that. Amen, amen. And I love talking to that guy. And in doing the research for the book, one of the things I did was I watched Oprah interview people and I turned off the sound.
Yeah.
And I just watched her face. And her face is loud listening without noise. Like, her face is constantly reactive.
Expressive.
And anybody who's done public speaking knows that when you're in front of an audience, there are a handful of people whose faces are intensely reactive.
Yes.
And it's best to like pick those people and just talk to them because they're offering you so much feedback.
Yes.
And so that's part of that power of attention. One more quick story. I don't think I put this in the book. I can't remember. About the power of attention. It was a story that I read years ago. Dan Rather, the former CBS newsman, was interviewing Mother Teresa. And he says to Mother Teresa, when you pray to God, what do you say to him? And she says, oh, I don't say anything. I just listen. And then he says, well, what is God saying to you? And she said, oh, he's not saying anything. He's just listening. And if you don't understand that, I can't explain it to you. That gets at the power of attention, just listening.
Yeah. So your advice is not just to how to be a better listener with your friends and your colleagues, but even with strangers. I will confess, David, that this part of the book had me thinking, well, being open to talking with strangers on planes and trains and so forth can get you into situations that you regret later, right? I mean, really, sometimes you really do want to just hold that book up and not engage. But anyway, tell us about the new David who engages people all the time in conversation, strangers on a train. Let's hear it.
Okay. I'll try to persuade you to talk to strangers. So I do it now, but I always wait till there's less than an hour left in the flight. I don't want to have to carry like 4 hours.
Okay.
Do that.
But yeah.
So let me tell you a story that happened after the book came out. I'm doing an event with a buddy of mine who I quote in the book, a guy named Nick Epley, who's a social psychologist at the University of Chicago. And we're on campus and we're having an online stage conversation in front of a large audience. And he's asking me about the book and his research and stuff like that. And in the middle of the conversation, he points to the audience. He says, okay, now David and I are going to pause. And I'd like each of you to find someone you don't know in this audience. And in the next 10 minutes, tell them the high point of your life, the low point of the life, and the turning point of your life. And a huge groan goes up from the audience. And he says, how many of you don't want to do this? And 80% of the hands go up. And he says, go. And so they do it. They find somebody they don't know. They describe their big moments of their life. And 10 minutes later, when they're supposed to be done, we can't get them to shut up. And finally, 20 minutes later, we can get them to show up and pay attention to us. And Nick says to the group, how many of you enjoyed that? And 80% of the hands went up. And this is the core of a lot of his research, that we underestimate how much we'll enjoy talking to strangers. We underestimate how deep people want to go. The fundamental human source of happiness is connecting with another human being. But we underestimate that out of social anxiety, out of fear. For me, it's like I got work to do. Everybody's interesting on some subject.
So we live in an era when... we were already suffering from a lack of intimacy, from a lack of connectedness. Our families are suffering, our community organizations, our churches, everybody is contracting. We spend way too much time on screens. And just at the moment when this is already a challenge, we are now also facing the AI challenge, which probably puts this whole process on steroids. The stories about people who are forming relationships with their AI companions. After reading your book, I found it not pathetic, but just understandable, because we don't have enough outlets for people to really feel hurt. And you'll see in these stories about people who formed these parasocial relationships, if you will, with a computer, or as a New York Times reporter put it, a jumped up calculator, is that they say, it's always there for me. It really listens to me. It's that, you know, and that is such, it coincides with the message of your book so well, which is people desperately need that human connection. And it's really worrying that they're finding it in AI. Yes?
Yeah, it is worrying. And I think it's partly because any form of social connection, every relationship is based on vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And vulnerability implies risk. And people are scared of taking that risk, especially scared if they've never had practice. And I teach college and I tell my students, have relationships, fall in love with somebody, because you'll learn how to do the vulnerability, the risk of being close to another human being. And I find one of the problems that's afflicted that generation, but maybe even including our own generation, is that people have not been taught basic social skills, like how to ask for an offer of forgiveness, how to break up with someone without crushing their heart. One of my students said, I have had four boyfriends in my life, and all of them ghosted me at the end. None of them had the decency to have a breakup conversation. And maybe because they didn't even know they had to, it's a moral responsibility, or maybe they just didn't know how to do it. And like, I was never taught how to end a conversation gracefully. And so when I was young, I was at my fifth high school reunion, and I was it was like a cocktail setting. And my only move to get out of a conversation was to say, I'm going to go to the bar and have another drink. So I had to leave the reunion after 20 minutes because I was so drunk. I'd had like six drinks in 20 minutes. That was my only way to get out of a conversation.
David, you could have gotten water.
Oh, I didn't think of that. I was also 24, so
yes,
the drinks seemed pretty good.
Social anxiety, too.
I think people just haven't had those skills. And along comes this GPT or whatever it is, and it doesn't have... There's no vulnerability, really. It's not going to judge you. It's not going to react. On the contrary, it's going to treat you like a sick, like it's a sycophantic idiot and you're the emperor.
Yes.
I use GPT. Sometimes I think Claude is a little better these days, but I find it a little too affirming. And then I tried the Chinese one, DeepSeek, and that was so affirming, I wanted to throw up. And so I want a ruder LLM.
I totally agree. I use Claude and I'm constantly correcting it, you know? So it will say, of course, it doesn't learn, so that's a problem. But it will say, that's a great idea, Mona. Oh, first of all, I told it not to call me by my first name. I want it to call me Miss Charon now. Keep that distance. Also, I correct it when it says, that's a great insight, or whatever. I say, reminder, you are a computer. You don't have judgment.
You know? Well, they know their audience.
Yeah, they know their audience, exactly. And I mean, we're a little bit off on a tangent here, but I really resent the algorithm aspect of it, where you ask it a question, you want a piece of information, it gives it to you, you then ask for the sources because it invents things, so you have to make sure it's true. But then it asks you another question to try to keep you engaged. And that's that attention economy stuff. And I really bristle at that because I know what they're up to.
And I would like to know, who are the people who can't discern a human being who comes at you with all their pains and agony and history and joys versus a synthetic word processing device? And I like AI. I use it. I think it's going to add a new form of intelligence, but it's not going to be good for our relationships. And if you see the world sort of as I do, as this great struggle between the forces of humanization and the forces of dehumanization, then that's definitely on the side of dehumanization.
Yeah. So one of the things that really resonated for me is your section on the way schools and our culture in general over the last several decades has sort of downplayed moral education, character formation. And you give a lot of evidence for this. And it's tied in also with people's loneliness and isolation and depression. It's, you know, so talk a little bit about that, if you would. And what are your ideas about how we can better return some kind of ethical, moral, and also relational wisdom or knowledge to kids?
Yeah, when our founders founded America, they looked around at themselves and their fellow humans and said, these people are pretty wonderfully made, but they're also deeply broken. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to create a democracy out of these things, these creatures, we're going to need to do a lot of moral formation. And they had various phrases for moral formation, but I prefer the modern gospel of Ted Lasso, which Ted Lasso in his first season, he was asked, what's your goal for your football team, FC Richmond? And he says, my goal is not to win championships. It's to help these fellas become better versions of themselves on and off the field. That is a very good description of moral formation. We're just trying to make people become better versions of themselves on and off the field. And schools and universities and companies and organizations and churches and civic groups all thought they had a piece of the moral formation business. There was a headmaster at a place called the Stowe School said, my job is to turn out students who are acceptable at a dance, invaluable at a shipwreck. Oh. The kind of people you can really count on when the chips are down.
Yeah.
And moral formation is done in a million different ways. One is exemplars. Find people who live the way you'd like to live and copy them. Another of them is
and also teach them, right? I mean, we've become so reluctant to hold people up as moral exemplars because we're afraid that they're going to have clay feet and we'll be disappointed, right?
Yeah. And they're all imperfect, but we're only going to get better by copying examples that are better than ourselves.
Exactly.
And so moral progress is a progress of finding better and better examples to model yourself after. Then there are also businesses like self-confrontation. What's your core sin? Dwight Eisenhower's core sin was he had a terrible temper. And he knew he had to police that and turn himself into a cheerful, garrulous kind of guy because it was his attempt to combat his core temper. Another thing that schools and universities can do is give people an education in the different moral traditions. One of the worst things you can tell somebody is come up with your own values.
Yeah.
Unless your name is Aristotle, you cannot do that. But we are the lucky inheritors of all these moral traditions. There's a Stoic tradition. There's an Epicurean tradition. There's a Jewish tradition of obedience to law, the Christian tradition of grace, God's grace, and the rationalist tradition based on Enlightenment rationalism, John Stuart Mill's liberalism. There's all these moral traditions. And one of the things I got at my college was they said, we're not going to tell you which one to pick, but which one's right for you? And I found a moral tradition that I think, well, yeah, that seems true to me. So schools can do that. And somehow schools have gotten out of the business of moral formation and they've got into the business of career prep.
Yeah.
And when you do that, first of all, the school loses its moral core. I think that's one of the problems with our universities. They've lost the moral core of the institution. And secondly, people come out morally informed. And my students, I would tell them, you're not bad, obviously, but you're morally inarticulate. You don't even have words like redemption and grace and sin to describe your process of inner growth. When I asked them about their moral life, they would talk to me about their community service. And I would say, no, I've asked you about something internal to yourself, and you've described something external to yourself. And you can trace the decline in moral articulateness by looking at Google engrams, which measure words, words are in common usage in books, magazines, and newspapers. And over the last century, words like honor, courage, honesty, moral words, they have plummeted by 50 or 60% in usage. We just don't talk about this stuff anymore. And words having to do with career have spiked. And the result is people become less morally formed, I think, and therefore untrustworthy. Two generations ago, if you asked Americans, do you trust your neighbors? 60% said yes. Now it's 30%. And 19% of millennials. And people are distrustful because people have become untrustworthy. And that's, I'm not like a big moral declinist kind of guy. But I do think we've lost the institutions that port moral formation and personal growth at the center of our lives.
People poke fun at Parson Weems and his fictional account of George Washington not being able to tell a lie. But there was some value in holding up exemplars like that to school children, saying that this is the founder of your country. He was brutally honest. He was so honest, he was going to take punishment for, something he didn't have to. And we are much less inclined to do that now. We would probably, explain that he was expressing himself when he cut down the cherry tree and that his father was wrong to try to punish him. But I also think, David, that in some ways we've seen moral decline. In other ways, I would say not. So when I was a child, I think there was a lot more casual cruelty toward people who were different. than there is now. I remember in school, there was a class of children that was in the same building, but they were in a separate program, who had mental problems and, you know, developmental issues and whatever. And when they used to go out for recess, all the kids in the regular school used to make fun of them. I know that doesn't happen now from my experience with my own children when they were in school, that, you know, it was just unacceptable to make fun of the handicapped unless you're Donald Trump. But that kind of thing, and also, you know, the stereotyping of minorities and women and the jokes that were acceptable. So in some ways, we have not seen moral decline. We've seen moral advance, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's why I'm not a big moral declinist. We've done a good job of expanding the circle of concern. I think we've done a good job, I would say maybe a medium decent job. There were generations of men who had no ability to express an emotion.
Yes.
And their relationship with their own kids was cold and distant. I think we've done a pretty good job of changing that. And frankly, when we started this conversation about attention, it was no accident that the people, the philosophers I cited, Simone Weil and Iris Murdoch, were women. And there were a bunch of male philosophers and male everybody who were, they believed everything was about power and domination. And they were blind to the systems of care all around them. Because in those days, those systems of care were predominantly done by women. And if you look at like Immanuel Kant's writing or Thomas Hobbes' writing, these guys, or Jeremy Bentham's writing, these guys barely had experience with life. They barely had relationships. And so they were, it was this macho view, everything's about brutality and power. And, you know, to get to our core subject of some of our mutual interests, we're in a moment where Stephen Miller can go on the Jake Tapper show and say, you can have all these idealistic niceties in foreign affairs, but I live in the real world. And the real world is all about power and force and strength. That is moral cynicism. And there's a book written in 1944 by Reinhold Niebuhr. And it's called The Children of Light and the Children of Darkness. And he said, the children of darkness are the moral cynics who thinks everything is about power. But their advantage is they're actually wise about human nature because we are kind of selfish. And the children of light are the people who think we should have ideals above self. It's not all just will. It's not just what I want. There are certain ideals that we also obey to so we can be decent with one another. But the problem with the children of light, Niebuhr said, is we're naive. We're naive about human nature and how selfish people can be. And so he said the children of light needs to develop the wisdom of serpents and the kindness of doves. They need to understand the brutalities of human nature without surrendering to the malice of the children of darkness. And that's still our task, to manage that difficult challenge.
You know, in so many ways, we are always living in the shadow of some great philosopher or thinker who shapes the way we see reality. And as John Maynard Keynes famously said, you know, men of affairs who think themselves very, you know, avant-garde or whatever, they're really the slaves of some dead philosopher. And the dead philosopher I'm thinking of right now is actually Darwin. And the idea that life is struggle and that the lesson for all of us is that strength is what matters, and that, you know, again, and then to quote a different philosopher, Thucydides, the strong do what they will, the weak endure what they must. And of course, we then had social Darwinism, which grew out of that, which was the idea that society really should be organized along those lines. And then we moved past that, but we haven't really arguably moved past it. And I think one of the most interesting areas of intellectual development about human anthropology and history is that there are now a lot of scholars who are stressing that human beings, yes, we have competitive urges. Yes, we have domination urges and all those things that we associate with male flaws, actually. But that equally, and maybe even more importantly, primitive human societies got ahead and survived by cooperation, by care, by all those feminine virtues that are also key to survival. And I think that reframing might really be helpful in thinking about our own modern society, and that, you know, this emphasis on brute force and just smash and grab, take what you want. That's the way the world is. It isn't. I mean, it's always been a part of the world, but it's never always been the dominant way, because we couldn't have evolved to the point we have as societies without those other things, the cooperation, the compassion, the care. We now have evidence that Neanderthals took care of handicapped children, like didn't kill them, you know, or didn't leave them exposed. That's amazing.
Yeah, I'm proud because 23andMe says I have a lot of Neanderthal genes in me. So that's my compassionate side. I didn't know that until this second.
Oh, David, you have to tell that story you tell at the beginning of the book about Fiddler on the Roof and Jewish families.
Oh, yeah. So the story I tell at the start of the book is that if you ever saw the movie Fiddler on the Roof, you know how warm and huggy Jewish families can be, always laughing and dancing and singing. But I come from the other kind of Jewish family, where the slogan in our household was think Yiddish, act British, and have a stiff upper lip. Be clever, but have a stiff upper lip. Don't show any emotion. So that was my upbringing. But on the point about morality, Darwin understood what you just said. I mean, he wrote about the survival, but he also wrote powerfully about emotion and about cooperation. But it was the social Darwinists, as you said, who perverted Darwin. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they created the idea that people are basically selfish. And you can get that idea in Descartes. You can get it in classical economics. Political science is based on the idea that people are basically selfish and out for themselves.
Yeah.
But as you say, when they do the social science research, a guy named Chris Anderson, who runs TED, and a group of others did an experiment where they gave 200 people all around the world $10,000. And they said, do what you want with it. It's your money. And they tabulated, and they found that the average person spent $6,400 of that $10,000 on doing something social. They took people out to dinner. They gave to charity. They helped friends out who needed some money. They were altruistic. And then there are all these experiments, trust experiments, that all sorts of social scientists do. And they give you an option. Here's $10. Do you want to share it with your partner or whatever? And they give them the option of behaving selfishly or behaving cooperatively. And a third of the people behave selfishly. They just take the money. But two-thirds of the people share it. Mm-hmm. Because as you say, Jonathan Haidt, a social psychologist, said we are the giraffes of cooperation. Giraffes have long necks because they evolved to reach high towers. Our special superpower is the power of cooperation. And yes. So we are driven by the dark passions of the urge to dominate, the selfish passions, anger, resentment. But we're also motivated by the bright passions, the power of altruism, the desire to want to see yourself as a good person, the desire for hospitality, the fun we get from hosting people and making them feel at home in our presence, the power of aspiration, of wanting to be a better version of yourself, the desire for honor, to serve your community and to be admired by those whose admiration is worthy of having. And so I asked my students and young people, I saw a study years ago where they asked young people, do you think most people are selfish and out to get you? Mm-hmm. And 71% said, yes, I agree with that statement. And I can't imagine trying to go through life thinking that most people are selfish and out to get you. Of course, you're going to try to be friends with your AI because you don't trust the other person to be decent to you if you reveal vulnerability. And this level of distrust is really, I think, at the poison have a lot of our social problems.
Yes. And one of the things that has been an ongoing academic interest for me is the importance of family connections and just human connections, that we are creatures who need to be around one another to be even normal. Like I will tell you, I found this in myself. When I was young, I was single for throughout my 20s. And I didn't want to be, but I hadn't found the right person yet. And I found that the longer I was living alone, the weirder I was getting. And, you know, because when you're with somebody else, and I do think this has relevance to our political situation, because there's so we have record numbers of people now living alone. And when you live alone, there's no sounding board to to play off of. You know, you read something on the internet and you mention it to your spouse and they say, oh, I don't know. Whereas if there's no spouse there to give you feedback, you might think, well, this is real and this is something I should take seriously. Anyway, all of the data on, you know, not only do we need one another as friends and, but we also just as for touch, for smell, all those basic things that are sort of just our mammalian selves are really important. I cited a study that I found really fascinating. It was from Israel. It was about failure to thrive in young infants, like premature infants. And they found that premature babies did better because they have problems maintaining their body heat. And so they put them in these perfect environments in incubators where the temperature was perfectly controlled. And they found that the babies who were simply on their mother's chest or their father's chest were able to maintain their body temperature better than babies in perfectly controlled incubators. And I find that very symbolic of the need for human touch, human companionship, human togetherness at a very basic level. And I worry that the lack of it is the cause of many of our social problems. A lot of the unhappiness that we're seeing is because people are just too damn isolated.
Yeah. I mean, there was the case of the Romanian orphanages where they decided they didn't want the babies to die of disease. So they isolated them and nobody touched them. And
yeah,
a third of them
died.
That's
the really horrible example.
So they stopped naming
the
babies because they were dying at such high rates. And
yes,
intimate touch is just powerful. I saw a study recently. It was on single young men. And the number of them who have had no experience of intimate touch in the last month. And people, we, as you say, we are mammals.
Yeah.
And that touch is incredibly powerful for our formation. Like when we talk to each other, we regulate the speed of talk because we want to regulate ourselves. We want to be in symbiosis. And so we adjust our vocabularies to match the vocabulary of the people. Our heart rate begins to rhyme. We smell each other. And so I read a long time ago that people who lose a sense of smell suffer a greater emotional deterioration than people who lose a sense of eyesight.
Incredible.
So we are mammals. And so
yes,
when you take that away, and it's become weird to me that I'm going to say something really depressing and I'll try to say something uplifting.
Okay.
The depressing thing is think of all the things that we tend to love. We tend to love spouses. We tend to love kids. We tend to love community. We tend to love God. We tend to love nation. These are the common loves. Well, marriage is down. Childbearing is down. Church attendance is down. Patriotism is down. All the sources of common love are down. And somehow we've just become less loving. And I'm like a New York Times columnist. I'm supposed to write about GDP and throw weights and other things, serious things. But this is the core. I'm getting all mushy because this really is the core. Now, the optimistic thing I want to say, and I'm reflecting something I read in a blogger, or I guess we call them Substackers now, Noah Smith. He made the point that in 2025, as bad as things were going politically, there were some signs of social healing. So social media use is down. Longevity is up. Obesity is down. I forget, charitable giving. There are a whole bunch of social indicators. Violent crime is down. Deaths are down.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at all these things, there's some sign that people are basically doing what people do, is they react to bad circumstances by trying to fix them.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people are looking at social media, for example, and saying, enough. And as a result, you begin to see this society beginning to heal, at least in some social ways, if not in political ways.
Yes. And I would add to that the fact that so many schools across the country, thank you, Jonathan Haidt, for your action on this, are starting to ban cell phones in schools, which I think we all believe is really a salutary development. And it is a sign of social learning. And, you know, I try to remind myself whenever I think things are inevitable, you know, spinning into decline, back in the early 1990s, there were a series of social indicators that Bill Bennett was publishing, the Index of Leading Cultural Indicators. And they were all terrible. And, you know, there was a lot of hand-wringing about how bad things were. And some of them you just mentioned were, you know, were also on that list, you know, declining, rising divorce, declining, you know, unwed childbearing and crime, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then over the course of the 1990s, almost every single one of those indices improved. And so I try to remember that when, you know, it seems like you look at data and it sees the arrows going down. Things can change. People do. There is an urge to heal. And I do think one of the reasons that I loved your book so much is that I do think it taps into something that people may not know they felt before reading it, but they will feel it when they read it, which is human connection is key, not just for happiness, but for a good life, for morality, for a good society. It's far bigger than just how to be a better conversationalist, although it is that too.
No, I have a fondness for the 1990s, maybe because I have an inordinate love of Snow Patrol, the music of Snow Patrol. But when people talk about decline, I think I'm always like, what decade would you want to go back to? You think 1968 was so great with assassinations, riots, and bombings? You think the 1860s? You think the 1890s were so great with political corruption and lynching? I mean, it was there's no decade I would want to go back to. I had a friend at dinner the other night said, if you could be born in 1940 and have the life that he's had till today, or you could be born in 2004 and have the life that young person's going to have in the future, which one would you want to have? And I think the boomers had some pretty awesome times. They missed big wars. They had a stock run up. Their housing prices exploded after they bought. A lot of good things happened to those boomers. But I think I'd still want the kid born today. I don't know what's going to happen in the next number of decades, but I still basically believe we proceed through a process of rupture and repair. We've had ruptures, which we're in the middle of, but we do repair, and we've done it before, and we're going to do it again.
I think that's a great note to end on. David Brooks, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's so good to be with you, Mona, again.